Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Organic Grower School, offering a Cuba agroecology tour in the summer of 2021. Learn more at organicgrowerschool.org.
Welcome to another episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. We have the distinct pleasure and the honor of inviting someone that, first of all, I have a lot of appreciation and love for, Steve Sando. He's the founder of Rancho Gordo Beans, who I've been a big proponent of and supporter of for many, many years. Rancho Gordo is an heirloom bean company based in Napa, California. And yeah, it translates to fat ranch, but that doesn't necessarily capture really what they're all about. Steve comes from a background of web design, and you know, the guy's been all over. I mean, he was a jazz radio disc jockey, just to show you his unbelievable reach. And you know, started with some heirloom tomatoes and then branched out and had no real experience into agriculture, but he felt it was a calling for him and he wanted to help market beans, right? That's really what it's all about. He decided to grow the beans and then gather bean seeds from Seed Savers Exchange and then move all over places like Oaxaca, Mexico to really locate the producers and make sure that he can bring those wonderful varieties here up north to the States. And since that, he started from 300 pounds in 2001 to 150,000 pounds in 2007. And you get the idea. It's been an unbelievable ascension for Rancho Gordo. They're considered the premier producers of heirloom beans in this country. And I can't tell you how much, Steve, it means to us for you being here. You support local farmers from places all over Mexico, Peru, Poland, Bolivia, even Oregon and Washington here locally. So muchísimas gracias. Thank you for being here. It's an absolute honor.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here too. Unfortunately, I'm somewhat of a fanboy for both of you. So the Mutual Admiration Society.
Well, you know, I felt when you sent me that book, I've been reading it, and I just feel like as if I know you. You know, that you're, yeah. I love the way you write. It's so personable, and you know, how you give space for the people that you work with in Mexico. And it's just warm. It was so warm, and all the recipes, those are the kind of recipes I want to cook, even though I wasn't like a real bean cook, but you know, but now I'm going to be. But anyway, so I'm thrilled to have you here. It really is wonderful. Thank you.
The funny thing is, I have people now trying to copy what we're doing, but I'm not an ag guy. I'm a very poor business person, but also building a better relationship with Mexico. I mean, we're the worst neighbors imaginable, and actually, what can we do that's non-political, that's really wonderful, is break bread together or tortillas and have beans and realize how much of a shared culture we have. So for me, it's totally out of passion. It has nothing to do with
all right, Steve, so what was the bean? What was the gleaming of the bean? Like what was that moment where you're like, you know, out of all the segments of Mexican food and culture, you know, where people of corn, where people of Chile, all the Mesoamerican diet, which is so essential, you know, why beans in that particular category?
Well, as you said, I started growing tomatoes and I thought I would do heirloom tomatoes, especially ones from Mexico. I thought that would be fun, but they were taking too long to ripen. So I did beans and I grew an heirloom called Rio Zape. And I thought, oh wait, this is like the pintos that I really like, but I love this. There's little hints of chocolate, there's hints of coffee. And it's like, how is this not known by every home cook? Mm-hmm. And why is it a rare thing only for people who do seed saving and grow at home? So, I mean, that was kind of the start of it.
Got it.
And I think, you know, beans are cuisine neutral. Everybody can get behind them. It's not, they're from Mesoamerica, but actually some of the best breeders were the Italians. And now, like I said, we get this bean. The Royal Corona is roots in Oaxaca, bred by Italians, produced in Poland. So it's, to me, that's about as romantic as it gets.
I think I had a girlfriend like that once. Anyway,
yeah.
Mom, a question for Steve?
A question for Steve. You, of all the little things that you send me, the ayocote beans, mm-hmm. were just, I mean, is that like one of the maximum varieties of beans or what?
Well, it's interesting. When we first started, so actually I'm doing our 20-year anniversary next year. So it's been 19 years of doing this, which it's aged me greatly, but it's been fine.
Stop
it's been
it.
A fun you ride. But when we started doing, you know, my idea of a good time is to go to Mexico, go to the markets, find the oldest woman on the outskirts of the market and buy beans from her and find out incredible rare ones. But then we worked with a company called Shashok that has helped us for actually importing them. Because when I first started, I would go and ask for beans so we could grow them here. And apparently that's the most offensive thing I could have done. And, you know, the indigenous farmers are like, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to give you my beans, which they understood beans are seeds and seeds are everything. So there's this real love of the seeds. But so we started importing the beans directly from the indigenous farmers, which it was like pulling teeth. And they look at me and it's like, oh yeah, there's a fat gringo. This is going to work in my favor. No, and they would shut down completely. And that's why it's been so great having my partners in Mexico. But one of the first beans I loved were the ayocote. And 20 years ago when we started doing this, it's like, ooh, those are for Indians. We don't want it. I mean, that's what Mexicans were telling me. It's like, they're really hard to digest. You don't want them. They're a bad bean. And now they're chic as can be. You see them in Mexico City restaurants. Yeah. But I'm telling you, 20 years ago, no one would touch them. But they think they can trace it back. That's one of the oldest cultivated crops in the Americas. And the Mesoamericans were much more advanced than the Europeans for crops. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, this bean that has traveled all over the world really is romantic, delicious, and one of the earliest ones.
Well, in Oaxaca, they prepared in mole coloradito. Mm. So what I did is, when you said me, I've been cooking with the beans all week long. And I made it with coloradito, and I sent it to this guy who has a Oaxacan restaurant. He went crazy with it. Have you done any exploring in Veracruz?
Yes. Well, with your book in hand, yes. So I think if I could go anywhere, I mean, I love Oaxaca, and my friends live in Hidalgo, and I mean, I love traveling. But to me, sitting on a beach with a bucket of shrimp in Veracruz is about as happy as you can be. And the bean rolls they do, you know, they have that beautiful black bean roll that is at least half manteca, but so what?
But, you know, they have so many dishes there, you know, like they have this puree with peanuts and bacon and sausage and ototitlan. Mm. They make the puff tortillas, the gorditas infladas, you know, which we spoke about in another occasion, but it's like really delicious. They have another one where they saute it in butter. You know, then I mean, it's just crazy. You know, it's like frijoles and achuchuk with crushed pumpkin seeds. I think that the Veracruz has the biggest variety of dishes with beans.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not going to say this right, but the infladas, is that right?
The infladas. You said it beautiful.
Gorditas infladas.
The most having those for breakfast was one of my favorite things. I think Veracruz is the great unknown gem. I think when people get a load of really, because not just the food, I mean, the music is incredible. The beaches are great. I mean, unfortunately, they've got some problems, but.
Who doesn't?
Ellen, the, what do you call it? The archaeological sites are worth a trip.
And I think it's something to be mentioned that you said the idea of the humility of the bean, but also it has that beautiful, luxurious note to it if it's prepared properly, right? And the idea of that every Mexican should be able to afford tortillas and afford beans. And I think that's important that we should talk about that.
It's like when I asked that man, how is the crisis affecting you? The crisis doesn't affect me because all I eat are beans, chili, tortillas, and there's plenty of that.
Well, except for the state of tortillas is a little bit better, but it's still pretty sad. Mm. The chilies are losing their pack because, you know, a lot of gringos don't want a lot of heat. And then the beans are often overprocessed. So in a weird way, it's easier than having to buy other food. But there is, you have to be smart about your pantry too, even with these three things.
All right, so let's break it down to the bean. We can get into varieties a little bit, just so we stay focused, because we're going to end up going on all these different ideas. For all of our listeners that are here that want experiments with bean, let's talk about the basics. Let's talk about, you get them from your beautiful Rancho Gordo bag, and they have, you have all that beautiful illustrations on the actual little tiquetas or the labels. What do you do there, and what are your suggestions, Steve, as far as soak, no soak?
I think you should do what you want. The secret is, beans are really hard to screw up. Mm-hmm. But if you haven't been cooking beans, it's really intimidating. You think, how am I going to turn this hard rock into something luxurious and soft? And that's the miracle of doing it. And you can soak them, and they'll cook faster. You can change the water. Some people believe that helps with digestion. Or you can not do it. And on Sunday mornings, I cook beans every week. If I think about it, I'll put them to soak. If I don't, I don't bother. And I like to make things hard for myself. I put them in, I cook them in clay pots, because almost every culture, and Mexican in particular, they'll say, you know, the best beans come from an oil de barro. I mean, the Italians do it, the Polish, everybody cooks in clay, but it's not necessary. I mean, I wouldn't get hung up. I think the problem we have is people who are somewhat new cooks cook a pot of beans, and it's such a miracle they did it that they tell everybody that the way I did it is the only way to do it. And they're not really realizing, it's like, look, we've been doing this for thousands of years.
Okay, Steve, you've been to our house, and we talk about how great our food is.
Yeah.
How about that mirepoix thing that you say, adding aromatics? Because that doesn't go really with Mexican food. You know, I could
do onion and garlic and manteca. I would add onion, garlic, and some manteca to start a Mexican pot of beans. I wouldn't do the mirepoix.
Yeah, well, I use a lot of manteca. Yeah. I've written a lot about manteca. It's going to be one of our segments.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Praise the Lord.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd say simmer till done. I mean, that really is the secret with a pot of beans. Now, you can do it slowly. You can do it in a pressure cooker. But basically, it's not intimidating. I personally don't soak. If I do soak, I don't change the water. I salt somewhat early. I still am superstitious, even though the science is telling us that you can salt from the beginning. You definitely don't want any acidic things. And also, I would say, do it vegan the first time, so you really get what is thrilling about the beans. And like, some people want, I cooked it really simply. I put a ham bone in it. And it's like, well, now you have a ham bone dish. I mean, honestly, the beans, if they're fresh, new crop, they can hold their own. They don't really need the help of pork. And of course, if you eat pork, have it with it if you want. But I'd urge, especially with heirlooms, it's like, why are you covering up this beautiful flavor?
I agree. Steve, that was well said. Mom?
You know that I had never become aware of how important the skin is in culinary things. I mean, you talk about the skin and the liquor that it forms. You know, it's fascinating, because I never think that the skin is going to come off. You know what I'm saying?
Well, sure, and it affects the pot liquor or the bean broth. The caldo is different depending on how thick the skin is. So if it's a thinner skin, you have this, usually it's often, sometimes there are mysterious exceptions, but you'll have a much more interesting bean broth. And for a bean freak, the liquid you make is like free soup, and it's the mold, which is why we don't cook cans unless it's an emergency, because you're supposed to rinse canned beans. So what does that say? I mean, you're missing all the beautiful bean broth.
Yeah, it brought a big appreciation to me, frankly, cooking with your beans. Even though I mean it, you know, because I grew up in a ranch, and my mom used to do this wonderful thing. She used to cook the beans and lard until they became chinitos, you know, like almost crispy.
Wow.
And they were fantastic. My mom was an amazing cook, you know.
And when you talk about that, Mom, the idea of like cooking, just we're on the subject of the whole chinito, when they get crispy, or literally when the fat rises to the top, right? Because a lot of times people understand, okay, so what's the idea between refried beans, cooking them straight up, all those. What I would like to talk about is just, okay, so you get your beans, you cook them regardless if you're a soaker or a non-soaker. Me particularly, I'm always trying to look for layers of flavor, because that's something my mom taught me from an early age. So I actually like to char vegetables and chiles and different aromatics and put that in my soaking liquid. Okay? And then I soak that. And then for me, the explosion of flavor, that dimension, is something completely different. And that's just something playing around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've never done that.
But try it. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
As far as denaturing the beans, that's up for debate. but the fact is, it's flavorful regardless.
Yeah.
I can't believe that I've forgotten to tell you the stories. I was always so bean-minded, you know, since I was a little girl. The first place that they ever took me was Mr. Bronson, who was an angel friend of the family, to El Paso del Norte Hotel. And the first thing I said, yo quiero un plato grandote de frijoles. I'll take a large plate of beans. That was my first restaurant experience. And I had an imaginary friend named Alicio. And I used to talk to him all the time. One day I came home and they say, you haven't mentioned Alicio very often. He said, no, se murió. He's dead. Why did he die? He drowned in a pot of beans.
Great, Mom.
I love that. But you know, I think a lot of times Mexicans take beans for granted because they're just there. And sometimes I remember when I first started, I was in some, you won't believe this, but some of the Mexico City chefs weren't as gracious as they might be.
That's a Chilango thing. Don't blame it on the chefs.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, Mexican food wasn't hip then. And then here was me coming down there saying, you know, you guys go to the tianguis and find these incredible beans. And they're like, they were going to the Mercado de Abasto and getting Peruvian peruanos or even pintos or Chinese black beans. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys, the treasure's right here. And so they resented it a lot in the very beginning. I had a lot of
they resent me too.
Kickback. I think it's taken for granted.
Yeah. Yeah. And who were some of your earlier supporters, Steve, when you started with this idea? You know, I know you're in Napa. My sister manages Hudson Vineyard, not far from you, and Christina and Lee and all the team out there. But was it an Alice Waters? Was it someone that got behind you early on that helped?
Yes. Well, I would go to the farmer's market, and that's where I started selling, and I was the loneliest guy at the farmer's market because everyone was coming for tomatoes or lavender or things that they weren't going to actually cook, and I had rocks. And people would even come up and go, the heirloom beans are just beautiful, the markings. And they'd go, ooh, I love nuts. Ooh, beans. And they were just all the time. But then Thomas Keller from French Laundry came by, and suddenly I was the belle of the ball. Mm. Like, he asked really intelligent questions. We went bean by bean, and he figured out where he could use them. And you know, he doesn't buy a ton, but it's important what he does buy. And after he left, it was almost like seagulls coming down after whales were feeding, or just every chef, every home cook wanted to know which were the Keller beans. So it was kind of interesting. And also in Mexico, you know, as I said, some of them weren't so gracious, but Enrique Olvera was immediately like, oh, this is really important what you're doing. And I appreciate that.
Cool.
He was very helpful.
Do you know Rafael Mier?
Yes, the corn. Yeah.
The tortilla guy.
Yes.
Well, he's also doing a lot of work with beans.
Is he now? Yeah.
Yeah, he's totally dedicated to that.
I actually did a book on pozole, which is, and he helped me a lot with the different indigenous corns and regional corns that were used there. Because a lot of people think cacahuate is the only one to use, but it really is.
Cacahuacintle.
It's very interesting.
You know that we have a friend who was on our second podcast, actually, episode, a young kid named Zach Wangerman, despite the name, he's from Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. And he is opening up a tortilleria all with native corn from Oaxaca.
Wow.
And all his ingredients, I mean, first of all, he's so knowledgeable. He's a young guy. He worked with Aron when he was 16.
Wow. So like Itanoni in Oaxaca?
Yeah, kind of like that, but it's you know, he's here in New York.
Wow. Well, you had the worst tortillas for so long, so I think it's so great you have now someone doing this.
It's true.
And they changed. These are native corn. It's completely different.
Love that.
Because the Mexican corn has that soft starch, and the tortillas stay soft. It's delicious. But we're talking about beans here. How about that? Those cassoulet beans that cost like $39 a pound, or what is it?
Yeah. If you go to France, I mean, and it's very controversial there. Some people, LaRousse has, I think they called it bola beans. I mean, somehow the Tarbé people got in that this is the bean you're supposed to use. And they're from a town called Tarbes. And
Steve, real quick, I'm sorry to interrupt. What makes one bean expensive versus another?
Well, for us, it's yield. So, I mean, some beans you can do thousands of pound, you know, per acre, and others you just get a really crummy yield. And unfortunately, with heirlooms, you tend to get a lower yield, and they're harder to grow, which is why they're more expensive. It's not a bougie thing where we're trying to bilk people.
But let's go back to cassoulet. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. No. No. Well, and that we I don't want to point fingers, but I think it's bad farming almost that did that. So this is this bean that's super rare. It's $30 a pound. And we found the seed and we grew it here in California, but we called it cassoulet just because out of respect for the farmers in France, we didn't want it. It was a terroir issue. So, and I don't even know if we could, but we didn't even want to. So we grew it and it grows like a weed in California. I mean, not a weed, but we certainly, it's not $30 a pound to produce. So we are doing really well with it. And it's a beautiful, creamy white bean that would be a shame to only use it for cassoulet. I mean, it's great. I do it with quelites. I do a quelites like in a Colorado and add some white beans. And I really sometimes wonder why I'm not a vegetarian when I eat that way. It's like, this, I can live on this.
Yeah. I just made a big pot of chile colorado.
Nice.
Yeah. I hate this kind of question, but I'm going to do it anyway. If you had three recipes that you would tell people to make sure to try, to appreciate, you know, the all the qualities.
Wow. Well, first, I'd have to say pot beans. So just do a pot of beans. And I feel weird telling you guys, saying this with you guys here, but a lot of people think you have to add hot chilies and everything. But actually, I think with beans and Mexicans, it's more important that you have a squeeze of lime and fresh raw onion, because they like that cream versus the crunch. And chilies are great, too. You definitely can do that if you want. But honestly, a squeeze of lime, a spoonful of white or red onion. Yellow onions are kind of too pungent, so you have to rinse them, but white you can go raw. And have that in a tortilla, and with tons of broth, I don't know what you can do better than that. I mean, to me, that's pretty exciting. But then I would say in frijoladas, if you, instead of enchiladas, you make a frijol sauce, which I think is pretty Oaxacan, although I guess I've only seen it in Oaxaca. I don't know if it is anywhere else. Yeah. And then beans and greens. I mean, that's also like we're just saying with the quelites, which are, you know, wild edible greens. But if you do Swiss chard or I'm not a huge kale fan, but you could do kale. I think it would work well. And beans, I mean, you've got I mean, it's food, drink, and lodging all in one bowl. So I think it's perfect.
Something is telling me that there are some sweets with beans.
There are, actually. There's a dulce de frijol that it's okay. And I know here in California, there's a group called Your Black Muslim Bakery, and they used to make a bean pie that was really famous. And there's a book called A Bowl of Red, which is all about Texas chili, written a million years ago. But he talks about having beans drizzled with honey.
And oh, yeah.
Tried it, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the red bean, the little mochis that they use in Asia as well, Mom. I mean, so there is that little connotation to go into the sweet. For me, I think what I would love for our listeners to get a better grasp of is, all right, so you have your beans. Not all beans are created equal. I think let's talk a little bit about what the heirloom variety versus mass-produced beans, because if we can summarize it, at one point we had a big playbook of beans and vegetables and everything. Then we kind of condensed it. Now we're rescuing. Now we're bringing back to light these beans that may have been a little bit more forlorn or thrown to the wayside. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that so our listener can understand that.
Well, first, I have to say I'm not a snob about beans, and that commodity beans that are easy to produce and are really productive have a role. It's cheap, great protein. So even though that's not my thing, I mean, there is a place for that. But the heirlooms, like I said, for me, this Rio Zape was the first one that I grew, and I like pinto beans just fine. But having them is like the nuance of flavor is just amazing. And there's not that, I know that some like kidney beans have a gumminess to them that isn't attractive. I mean, heirloom beans just don't have that. It's the flavors and the textures. I just don't think there's anything that you can compete with it. And also it's really regional. And I think it's really important to celebrate regional differences, you know, in the United States and in Mexico and all over the place. And yet at the same time, the most romantic thing to do is to take some ayacote beans, put them in your pocket, and go to Zanzibar and just start the tradition there as well.
Have you ever had that soup that you toast the beans? and then grind it to a powder.
Yeah, they use the mikate to grind them. Yeah, it's more work.
And it's like a sopa seca, azteca.
Yeah.
With avocado.
It's a lot of work, I think, but. You know.
Well, like this, I already repeated that story, so I can't tell it, but it's so good. It's better to lead the donkey than carry the load.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, though, too, you know, some people who are freaked out about cooking beans, the Instant Pot seems to be the product of the day, and it's an electric pressure cooker. And it's not my favorite way of doing it, but I was going to say it's really great to help people come on board with them. I know in Mexico, a lot of people will use a pressure cooker, especially at high altitude, but then finish it in a clay pot because they love the flavor and the more gentle cooking of it.
Steve, fantastic transition. I love the way you're thinking. We read that beautiful article about you talking about the different ways of cooking the beans. So I know that there's the romantic clay pot. You talk about pressure cooker. They all have different applications. What does one cooking method in part than another, if you can just give a brief synopsis?
Okay, so I'd say pressure cooking is speed.
Yeah.
But you've trapped the flavor. I mean, there's no reduction, so the bean broth is kind of dead. So I do think you have to cook it for another half hour or so. Slow cooker is ease, because you, like a crock pot, you're not there. So it's not, when you come home, it's really fun opening the door, and it's like, oh, the servants have been busy cooking for me all day. That's kind of a kick. I think enameled cast iron, like Le Creuset, is kind of, everybody seems to have gotten them for their weddings, and it's a great pot. Personally, I think that's where I would start with that. And it's just, it's hardy, and you can use the heavy lid open and closed to adjust the gentle simmering, and there's some evaporation, so your bean broth is going to be richer. And then clay, you just can't burn beans unless you work really hard. And also different clays within Mexico and in Europe, everywhere, have different flavors that actually impart. So that is the advantage of those as well.
I have La Chamba.
Yeah, those are great. Mm-hmm. We are working with a group of women in Los Reyes, Metzotle, in Puebla, near Oaxaca. And they have, is it like La Chamba, where it's unglazed, it's just burnished. And I used to, when I did farmer's markets, I would at night prepare beans for the next day to sample, and I'd use my Le Creuset. And half the time I was so tired, I'd wake up to the smell of burning beans, which, you know, is not a pleasant smell at all. And I couldn't burn them with clay pots. It's just this gentle, loving way of cooking. It's not for everybody, but it is an interesting
And also, way. I think it's important to designate a pot just for your beans, right? You don't want to adulterate your pot with some foreign entities, like something like a pasta fajol. We don't want to do that. No, you know?
Yeah, just one? I have many. I have many dedicated.
This episode is brought to you by Organic Grower School, offering a Cuba agroecology tour in the summer of 2021. Agroecology is the study of ecological systems as they apply to agriculture. Join Organic Grower School on their tour of Cuba this summer to learn more firsthand. During this trip, you'll participate in and observe how the Cuban agricultural community has fully embraced agroecology. You'll learn why Cuba is considered one of the leading global experts in agroecological methods. What's included in the Cuba agroecology tour? The 9-day itinerary includes lodging, transportation around the island, and 2 to 3 meals per day. You'll be led by a professional tour guide with agricultural experience through Havana, Viñales Valley, and the Las Terrazas Biosphere Reserve. Scholarships covering up to 75% of the trip are available, with farmers being prioritized. Learn more at organicgrowerschool.org.
I think one of the things that we can talk about, just as far as different applications, Mom, you cook my Moros y Cristianos recipe, which is a really great recipe, which I think is a technique that I think we should share with our listeners, as far as we're talking about bean liquor, that beautiful liquid of the bean gods. That could be used to cook rice. that could be used to stew a protein other than beans. So I think it's important to talk a little bit about that, using that bean liquor as a vehicle for other different applications and flavor.
Definitely with Moros and Cristianos. I love that.
Mm-hmm. And when you make it, do you cook them together?
No. You cook the beans separately, and then you cook the rice separately. When you start cooking the rice, well, you saute it with onion and garlic and herbs, because Aron's version has a lot of herbs. By the way, I'm going to put up all these recipes on my website. We're working on this. And then after that, you add the bean liquid instead of chicken stock or whatever.
Yeah. I'm getting shivers. That's so yeah. good. Yeah.
One of the cool techniques that I learned is, the bean liquid, in essence, has that goodness into it. And I remember working with Douglas Rodriguez, who's Cuban, who he really mastered the idea of black beans. So we would start with a big pot. He would make a really badass sofrito, Cubanella peppers, onions, garlic. Just onions and Cubanella peppers and some red pepper. Cook that, puree that, add that to the beans. And he would fry chopped garlic and throw that into the bean mixture. And like a good Cuban, a little bit of vinegar and some sugar. And then that would be the base and essence of what you would throw into the rice dish. And that would, in essence, make your Moros y Cristianos. Really, really special. Right. Yeah.
You know, another one of the dishes that's so unusual and fantastic in Veracruz is that they make this scrambled eggs with beans in it.
Mm. Oh, so, yeah. So, it's kind of ugly, but it's delicious.
Yeah. You don't expect that. You beat it together and then you cook it. It's really delicious.
Yeah. No. I was going to say, though, going back to the bean broth, when I have a party, I heat up little shot glasses of bean broth. And that's a great way to start the evening because it's so weird. And everyone's like, oh, what a dumb idea. And it's like, dang, this is good. And it's a nice thing. But I like cook rice in it, like you say. I poach eggs in it sometimes. Mm. I have little individual cazuelas that you can put right on the gas. No, it's good stuff.
With hoja santa.
Oh, yeah.
And epazote. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people, understand that, first, the one thing that kills my mom and I is that people think cumin is prevalent Mexican food. And one of the singular ways that you use cumin in Mexican cooking is through beans and also epazote. It's one of the few, let's talk a little bit about, Mom, those techniques, because I just want to dispel that myth that Mexican food has cumin everywhere.
The cumin is used as part of a trilogy, It has equal parts of cumin and canela, which is a Mexican soft stick cinnamon. It's not really Mexican, but they call it Mexican. And then 1/4 teaspoon of cloves. And that's used in picadillos. It's used in a lot of different dishes, that spice mixture. And you've got to remember that when the Spain conquered Mexico, the Moors had only been out of Spain not that long. So the thing is that a lot of the flavors that we have in Veracruz and Oaxaca and all those places has a little bit of a Moorish, combination of spices particularly. In the north, that's where they use the comino a lot. They use the cumin a lot. But in other places of Mexico, they really don't.
And the idea of epazote coming into it, Steve, from your experience, what has been the exposure and that sort of combination of epazote and beans?
Well, it's hard because I love it. People who are sort of in the know have heard about it and they're buying dried epazote, which I think is sort of like dried basil. It kind of doesn't work.
I don't agree.
Oh, I don't know. That's good.
Yeah, my mom used to make a tea with it.
Huh. And was it good?
And season the stuff with the tea and the leaves. So,
could you use the dried beans, do you think? How would you do it? Like in a tea bag and let it steep?
Yeah, you could do that. That would be a good idea.
Yeah. I don't know. It's such a weed that everyone should have a pot on their... I mean, I have a pot that I literally let die every year, and I thought maybe it's just dying back. No, it's completely dead, but it bolts, and there's so many seeds that this thing just comes back every year. And I'm in California, so maybe I'm lucky, but I have epazote all the time. And beyond beans, it's so great. Like, just in a quesadilla with epazote is...
Oh, I love that.
And if you pulpo, it's terrific too. I mean, epazote is a great herb that we should be using more of.
Yeah, Chinodum ambrosoides is the botanical name. But also the avocado leaves are used a lot in the beans.
Yes. So we apparently our California Haas avocado leaves don't have any flavor. So there, you really need a special leaf from Mexico. But I think people are starting to do, just like with the beans, they're doing heirloom avocados now. The Haases have taken over the world. And in fact, that's never a good idea to have a monoculture about any one crop. So I think more and more people are doing more interesting leaves. But oh, toasted avocado leaves is out of this world with black beans. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. Me too. Sorry, I'm going on my rant.
We want to hear it.
This is what it's all about.
Yeah, I'm a ranter.
Come on, bring it.
But we do need it for black beans. We have the ayacote negro, which aren't a true black bean at all. They kind of turn brown when they're cooked. But we have black teperis, and teperis are the only bean that's indigenous to the U.S., and they're a drought-tolerant little tiny bean that actually takes a long time to cook. But we're now working in Chiapas with some farmers. They have three black beans, and my immediate reaction is, no, we don't need any more black beans. And it's like, I think we're going to do all three of them. It's like, wow, this one is creamy, this one is meaty, this one has this pot liquor that you could just make soup just from it. And it, to me, this is where I get excited. But I see more and more in the big markets the Michigan black beans. And I think people like them because they stay black, but they really have not as much flavor as the different varieties there. We were in the Huasteca, which, you know, which is way up out of the way in Hidalgo. And we had heard about this one farmer that was growing really cleanly, because a lot of times they'll use black water, which is, you don't even want to know what that is. And we just heard there was a great guy doing heirlooms in the Huasteca. So we drove for hours to meet him. And we look, and the fields are beautiful. It's like, okay, this is going to work. And he sees me when we get out of the car, and he's glowing. And I'm like, this isn't usually what happens. So we said, what are you growing? We're all excited because it's Michigan black. He was so excited. He got the word that the money's with growing Michigan black beans for the international market. And it, for me, it actually started a sense of urgency. Like, this isn't for the cutes anymore. We have to go find guys like that and say, no, we want your grandmother's beans. And you can't compete with the Chinese or the Peruvians on commodity beans. What you should be doing, I think, is honoring your own heritage. I mean, it's easy for me to say because I'm not.
No, but stop it.
There is no market for, I mean, they're not going to be able to compete. But so what do? You specialize, I think. And let's talk about your grandmother's beans. And it's culturally relevant. So it's like, I'm not asking you to grow parts for a Ford factory for auto parts. And no, I'm asking you to just dig a little bit in your back pocket. So that's my.
Well, they certainly have done. They've done that in the corn business, you know, because so many people are bringing in native corn now that they've been able to resuscitate that, you know, that business in Mexico, the small fields and everything. It's really exciting to see, you know, there's like the corn liqueur and the corn whiskey. That's fantastic. It's very interesting what's happening just with the biodiversity.
It is. And as important as seed saving is, and different groups that are kind of wagging their finger telling us, it's like, actually the best way to save this stuff is to eat it.
Yeah.
Because you realize, oh, there is some value there. It's worth saving.
And I think what's important, too, is that we need to talk to, you know, how kids eat at school. I can't remember having beans at a school lunch. And being able to do that simple act of making beans available to the masses from a very young age, our most valuable commodities are our children. Being able to do that, I think, would be a really great step to being able to introduce that as a staple of young people's diets. As Mexicans, we took for granted that, but not necessarily.
They should make everybody a bean burrito.
And healthier would that be than doing processed pizza?
Yep.
That counts as a vegetable because you use tomato, sugary tomato sauce. I mean, I think beans, and I sometimes will go to schools and with cooked beans, and there's always these two or three kids, non-Mexican, that just like, I'm freaking out. It's like they keep coming more, and I'm like, okay, you got to slow this down.
Yeah.
Some issues later, but it's like, when you expose kids, most kids really love beans. And who doesn't like tortillas and a little cheese? And then maybe you sneak in some kind of vegetable on the side. It certainly beats processed pizza for school lunch.
Oh, absolutely.
It'll be easy enough to do.
If I may quote, since we're on this, for all of that are listening, you must look up a great 80s movie called The Milagro Bean Field. And in that film, there's a bunch of different great stuff. But one of them says, it's like, I may be poor, but I grow the richest beans. You know what I mean? And I think that is a metaphor about what we're talking about. This idea of the most accessible, one of the most accessible ingredients in Mexico that everyone can relate to, from different classes to everyone. You can find it in the street, or you can find it at Enrique Olvera's restaurant, Pujol. There's going to be beans represented. And I think that's what's something that's beautiful about this ingredient.
Yeah. And to me, it's supposedly the most lowly ingredient that is really for poor people or when you're broke. And here it is in these absolutely top restaurants. I mean, I love that irony about that.
So are you writing a new book?
Yes, I am.
Talk to us about it.
Well, it's premature, but I'm doing sort of a bean bible for a big publisher. Finally, I really was not in love with the publishing industry, believe it or not. So we just started our own press. And so we've been publishing our own books for about 8 years. But I do actually have a book deal coming up. But I also, my fantasy book I'm finally going to write is yet. And I know it's like, oh God, another gringo writing about Mexican food. But I really want to talk about the 10 years, especially 12 years now that I've been in Mexico meeting with these small farmers. And I want to tell their stories and the food we ate there. And it's more of a secret revealed, and it's really, I'm not pedantic or like, this isn't how things are done. This is what I saw at the Mexican food revolution that has taken place over the last couple of years. And we were there on the ground in the beginning, and it's kind of fun watching the whole thing happen.
Well, you're definitely an advocate and an ambassador of our cooking and our culture. It really touches my heart because so many people don't understand us. You know, we're right next door and they don't understand us. But it's been a real pleasure to get to know you a little bit more, and I hope that we're going to get some time to spend together live, face to face.
I'd love that. And I think we have a lot of gossip we could share.
You know, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, but and I think, Steve, you're doing something that's so valuable. I think the idea, like as my mom said, you know, as Mexicans, we don't get caught up in saying, oh, you know, there's another gringo writing a book. It's more, no, you're paying the best honor to us. It's an homage to us that you share that interest and you're sharing it with as many people as you can. So don't ever feel bad about that. We take that with the highest compliment and the highest amount of respect. So please understand that, okay?
I will. And
I think, Steve, we have a lot of friends in common. And I know that Napa and all what you guys are doing up in California is this beautiful community of just preserving ingredients and legacy through wine, food, and all that. So I'm sure we'll find ourselves in the same place down the road as my mom alluded to earlier. And we're just unbelievably grateful for you, for your time, for your knowledge, and your continued mission. You have no idea. It's how grateful we are.
This is going to be our closing segment, probably, of this season.
No, I'm honored. No, completely humbled. Like, you know what the coolest thing is, though? It's not like I said about 20 years ago, it's like, I'm going to make a ton of money doing heirloom beans. This is going to be a great way to make a living. If there's any lesson here, it's like follow your passions and
Exactly.
Just
you know, I do a lot of motivational talks. And one of the first thing is I say you have to find something that you're completely passionate about, that you will not be happy if you're not doing that.
Yeah, 100%. Also, even if you don't know anything about it, like I have no ag background. And I think that helped me because other people would have told me all the things you can't do. And it's just do it.
And you've done it so well and so successfully.
Thank you.
And you're doing service to a country and to a cuisine.
Wow.
And we thank you so very much for being with us today.
No, yes.
Anytime.
And everyone that's listening to your Cooking in Mexican from A to Z, we're so, so grateful to have Steve Sando here, founder of Rancho Gordo. You want to look up Steve and all the beautiful things that he's doing there at Rancho Gordo Beans, please look up ranchogordo.com. There's a really neat article on GQ.com about Rancho Gordo Beans that I think will give you a lot of insight to what we have touched upon on this podcast. Hopefully you guys have really been engaged and been and been enlightened with this beautiful subject matter and ingredient that is so, so fundamental to all Mexican cooking. I just can't tell you how much of the world of beans you have yet to discover. I think you couldn't find a better guide than Steve Sando, so please look him up. He's been an unbelievable supporter of this podcast, so we're eternally grateful for that. And please stay tuned. We're going to be doing more wonderful podcasts here on Cooking in Mexican from A to Z, brought to you by HRN. Muchísimas gracias.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.